Hi, my name is Florence. I'm an alcoholic. You're new here tonight, and you couldn't quite follow what Jesse was reading. It's the 12 steps. They're posted on the wall. More importantly, they're in the big book. It's chapter 5, How It Works. And if you're here for the first time tonight, get the big book because it has the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in it. And I don't know about you, but because of that, I haven't had to take a drink for over 2 years, and I'll be one of the people picking up a chip tomorrow. And Beverly D has 5 years today. I wasn't an alcoholic when I first came into the program. Not at all. It's I could control my drinking, or so I thought. It was a cultural difference. That was a good one to blame it on, too. Since I grew up in Holland, and we had more alcohol in the beer, and we drank more beer, and I drank Budweiser here, didn't have enough alcohol in it. I needed the alcohol, so I started drinking vodka. It was a cultural difference. I was not an alcoholic. And one day my wife left, and she said, if you're not going to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm not going to come back. So what choice did I have? It was over in the old room 44. And she had been going to Al-Anon meetings for quite a while. She had some alcoholics in her family, so she knew what she was dealing with. And the Al-Anon meetings were in room 44, which was only a few rooms down from where the AA meetings used to be. And I was convinced that if there would be a night that I didn't show up, she would hear about it, because, of course, there was this very intimate contact between all those active Al-Anons and active AAs. So I showed up. And I went out to coffee with somebody, and he suggested I get the big book and read the first 164 pages and see whether I was an alcoholic or not. But I had already read parts of the big book because my wife had it, and she had other literature also. Of course, I didn't tell her I read that. Actually, what I tried to do was read it, and it like the chapter 2 to wives, it tells them how to act with a drunk. And why some of the things they do the way they do. So I would try and do just the opposite to prove that I was not an alcoholic. I read that book, and I went out to coffee with that guy again, and I wanted him to tell me that I was an alcoholic, and he wouldn't do that. So I thought, wow, that's good. You know, he said, I don't know you're an alcoholic. I said, hey, this is good. This guy is in AA, and he doesn't know if I'm an alcoholic or not. That's hopeful. So I more or less decided that I was not an alcoholic after 1 week going to meetings, but then it probably wouldn't convince my wife. So I kept going to meetings, and I kept going to meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I worked the steps. And my wife still wasn't coming back. After about 9 months sober, she decided she wasn't ever coming back, so we started divorce proceedings and things like that. But by that time, I'd been around here long enough to know that I am an alcoholic. I had my first blackout when I was 16, and one of the things the big book talks about, and what you also see in the 20 questions, is blackouts. Some people never had blackouts. I had them all the time. I realized after I got sober and had been around here for a while. My first blackout was after school. In Holland, there's no real drinking age, so we went out and had a few beers. And the next day, my friends told me that I had done something to this girl. I don't remember what it was, but I didn't believe them. I thought they were pulling a joke on me. And it wasn't until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized what really had happened. Also, I used to live in Redwood City and work in San Francisco, and I would commute by train. And on that train you can drink, and they have a tiny little liquor type store in a station in San Francisco, and you can buy beer there and some hard liquor. And I would do that. I would work long hours, and it was kind of an inconvenient commute schedule. There was a train at 8 at night, and the next one was at 10 o'clock. So sometimes I'd get to the station by 9, gave me plenty of time to drink a little, and I would drink 2 pints of beer and a pint of vodka. And the train ride was about 45 minutes, and it would hit me just at the time I got home. And I did that day in, day out. And sometimes I tried not to do it, but then I got kind of desperate, because how am I going to survive the 45 minutes? You know, I did I could not conceive of that idea. My mind would race, my brain would race, and that just wasn't very appealing to me. What I also started noticing is, at home I always drank beer, you know, and I had no problem with that, but and here too, I would go to a party, I would have two beers, and I'd quit because I either had to drive or, you know, it was a work party or something. But as soon as I drank like a glass of vodka, which was my drink of choice, as soon as I touched any hard liquor, I would be gone. I would not be able to stop. If I would be washing the car on a Saturday afternoon, happily drinking my beer, listening to a Giants game, and the thought would enter my mind that, some vodka would be nice, I'd be passed out by 4 o'clock, no matter what happened or what was going to happen. A lot of these things I didn't realize. I started working the steps. Now, admitted I was powerless over alcohol, although at first I didn't really believe that. But my life had become unmanageable, and at first I called it my wife had become unmanageable. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and in order to do that, you have to admit that you're insane. And I always thought of myself as a sane person. But the longer I stayed sober, and the longer I stay sober, the more I realized how insane I really was. What the drinking did to me was I didn't feel. I thought I did, but I didn't. I had no emotions. Sometimes I did, but they weren't really real. When I first sobered up and I hadn't had a drink, it was weird. I had all these feelings inside that I didn't know what to do with. And at that time, people could still curse from the podium, and the only way I could express my feelings was in four-letter words. That was really funny, because you guys taught me how to express my feelings. Now I have lots of feelings, and I like them. I like them a lot. You know, I don't like them when they're bad or sad or negative, but I love them when they're good. There's nothing nicer, or nothing makes me feel nicer, than trying to pass on this message or working steps with another newcomer. And at first seeing that misery or desperation, and then as time goes by, you see the lights come on as we work through the steps together. There is growth, and not only in the person that you work with, but also in yourself. Because as they say here, in order to stay sober, you got to give it away, but it also lets you read those steps again, and it lets you read the big book again, and you got to stay on top of things. And that's really good. I love that. I love that. Sometimes, though, for some reason, all of a sudden I get these cravings. That's really weird. Fortunately, it's been a while. I've been coasting since Christmas, and I'm getting kind of scared. Like, when is this going to be over? When is the shit going to hit the fan again? But I've been doing good. But I think it was last August or September or sometime around that all of a sudden I wanted to go out and get drunk badly, and I couldn't really figure out why. It got so bad that I could smell and taste the whiskey, and I didn't even have it around me. It was right in the middle of the day. I was at work, and I got the shakes. That was another proof for me that I most definitely am an alcoholic. So I called my sponsor. I said, "What do I do?" He said, "Well, call central office and tell them you're available for a 12-step call." So I talked to my boss. I said, my boss knows I'm in the program. I said, "Well, I'm going to have to make myself available to do that 12-step call if it comes in." And so I did. It didn't come in, but just making that call made me feel so much better. It made the shake stop. It made the idea go out of my mind. I like that. Today my life is good. My first year of sobriety was misery. My second year was like over in no time. And now life is just wonderful. And I don't know why. I didn't do much about it. What I do know is that in those past years, I tried to work the steps real hard. And I tried to get a good conscious contact with a power greater than myself. And I gave up things that I have no control over anyway. That's something else that the steps teaches you. I used to worry about a lot of things that I found out through working the steps I don't have to worry about, because I can't do anything about them anyway. So why waste my time and energy worrying about that? And that makes me feel a lot more relaxed than I used to be. Makes me feel peaceful. If you're new here tonight, once again, get a big book and listen to people share from the podium what it was like for them. And listen to the similarities and not the differences. See, I was lucky. I came in here and I had a big stick behind the door. And I stayed around long enough to know for sure that I was an alcoholic, so that I did, when I didn't have to stay here anymore, I stayed anyway, because I know for myself this is the place to be. But you know, coming to meetings and building up friendships, another tip when you're new that really helped me stay sober is when I first came into the program, I introduced myself as a newcomer, and somebody sitting right beside me, or maybe a few chairs down, also introduced himself as a newcomer. And we went out to coffee together, and we've been going out to coffee together ever since. Almost every time we're at the meeting together, we go out to coffee. And we have kept each other sober because we went through the same things at approximately the same time. If I asked him how he was doing, he started crying the next day. It'd be the other way around. He'd ask me how I was doing, and I would like burst out in tears. And it's really nice to have somebody there that you can go through the feelings with, that you're going through, that's going through that same thing. I know if it wasn't for that particular hookup, I probably would not have been sober today. Anyway, keep coming back, because that's what they kept telling me. And that's absolutely necessary. That's absolutely necessary, because if you don't come back, or if you don't come back often enough, your mind plays tricks. I was out of work for a while in my first year sober. I went to 2, sometimes 3 meetings a day. And after that, I found a job. But going to that many meetings gave me the foundation that I needed to go through some of the misery and bullshit that happened after that. And I'm glad I did that. This is a wonderful program. It has wonderful people in that. Get a sponsor or fill out the temporary sponsorship slip and get at it. We love to have you here. And in order for us to stay sober, we need to give it away. Thanks for letting me share.
My name is Sam, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Well, I guess I'm here to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm a local boy. I was born in this valley in 1949. And I grew up in an upper middle class neighborhood on the west side of the valley by the Rose Garden area. And I had everything I wanted when I was a kid materially. But I can remember as far back as I can remember as a child, I just didn't feel like I fit in any place. I felt like I was on the outside. And I can remember when I was a kid, there'd be all these little groups of kids at school, and I'd always be on the outside looking in, and I just never quite fit in. And I didn't socialize with other people and become part of anything. I was always a loner. I was a good student, you know. I was a good student up until about the 7th grade, and when I turned 13, all hell broke loose. I sought out the crazies when I got to junior high school. I sought out the guys who were wild and crazy and didn't give a damn about anything and just looking for cheap thrills. So my life took a 180 right there, and I ended up in juvenile hall when I was 13, and I had a fifth of Tokay in my pants when they busted me. What happened was I ended up going through school, and I made it through high school, but around about the age of 17, I got involved heavily in drugs and alcohol, and I started using a lot and drinking a lot, and hanging with that group that was living on the edge. And From the time I was in my late teens until the age of 34, I was off to the races. When I first started, I can remember one of my first drunks. I can't remember my first drunk, but one of my first drunks was the night before Easter Sunday. And some friends of mine went in the liquor store and we stole a quart of J&B, a quart of Canadian Club, and some other stuff. And I grabbed a bottle of Canadian Club and I wouldn't let anybody else have it. You know, once I got that glow going, once I caught that buzz, and, you know, I thought I'd found nirvana, you know, in that that quart of whiskey. And next morning I ended up in church with my parents on Easter Sunday, turning green, feeling like my guts were going to come up and I was going to turn inside out. But, you know, shortly after that I forgot about the paying my dues after the fact. You know, I was going after that buzz, that warm glow that starts in your stomach and goes out to all your extremities and makes you feel like Superman. What happened was I started to lose interest in most things besides getting high. And directly after high school, I didn't do anything. I can remember being 17 years old and being called in a counselor's office for an interview, and it was some old grandma type that I'd never met before, and she looked at me and said, "Well, what do you plan on doing with your life after high school? Are you going to seek a trade? Are you going to go on to college? Are you going to seek a professional career?" And I looked at this woman like she was nuts. You know, it's like, what are you talking about? I don't even know what I'm doing tomorrow, next week, next year. You ask me what I'm going to do with the rest of my life? And that's the way it went for me. I didn't have any direction. I didn't have any goals. And I was living nuts from day to day. What happened was I got to hanging out with guys who were just like me, who didn't have any direction and didn't care what was going to happen to them and wanted to block out reality. So, you know, we went through our phases. We did a lot of uppers, and then we do a lot of downers. And the alcohol was always there, you know. No matter what else we were doing, alcohol was always there. And I can remember not having any money wasn't the point. I could always get the drugs and get the alcohol. I didn't need money, you know. I can remember my mom was into, you know, matching shoes and handbags back in the 50s and 60s. She had tons of shoes and handbags, and they all matched. And she'd always leave change in these bags when she'd change from one outfit to another. So when she wasn't home, I'd empty out all of her handbags and get her change together. You know, that's where I was at. And go down to the store and see how far we could stretch it. You know, like a half gallon of Thunderbird, $2.39. Or 4/5 of Pig and Pink Ripple, or, you know, whatever I could get, you know, quantity, not quality. And what happened was my buddy started to die off. You know, I was a product of the 60s. You know, I went through my teenage years in the 60s, and I turned 21 at Elmwood in 1970, doing half a year on a felony drug conviction. And into the early 70s, I was talking to my sponsor the other day, and I said, you know what? I don't remember most of the 70s. You know, I lost most of a decade there someplace. And he says, well, maybe you're not supposed to remember the 70s. But the point is by the early 70s, my friends started dying. My best friend out of high school overdosed on heroin in the backseat of a car. So what did his buddies do? You know, we were tight partners. Drove up to the emergency at Valley Medical and kicked him out of the car and drove away. Yeah, that's how your buddies treat you. Another good friend of mine blew his brains out in front of his girlfriend, you know. And, you know, on and on and on. You know, and these were strange things to other people. I'd say, your friend did what? And it wasn't any big deal to me because it was part of the lifestyle, you know. What happened was I finally got a career going of sorts by the time I was 27 years old. From the time I got out of high school, I spent about 10 years sponging off of relatives and other people, You know, when everything fell apart, we'd always go back to Mom's house. Mom would always take you back in, you know, take care of her boys. I got a career gone because of my alcoholism as a direct result. I was collecting general assistance and living at my mom's place, and the social worker called me up and says, says on your forms here you took drafting in high school. You want to take it again? And I said, are you going to pay me and give me my food stamps? And he said, yeah, we're going to do that. Do you want to learn something? and I said, sure, why not? So they sent me to drafting school, and I got an entry-level position. This was in 76. And I can remember going to that school, and you had to show up. And if you missed four days, they could throw you out of this school. Well, I'd missed 3 days behind my drinking, and then that fourth one came up. And so I called the teacher aside, and I said, look, I got to explain something to you. I'm an alcoholic. And he says, well, what do you mean you're an alcoholic? And I said, I drink a lot. And he says, well, you don't see spiders or monsters or go through the DTs, do you? And I said, no. And he said, well, you're not an alcoholic. And I just kind of looked at him funny like, geez, what's your brand of alcoholism? And what happened was I managed to get through that drafting school, and I got a job going. So then I had a steady income, and I could buy whatever I wanted, you know, and I could support my habits. So around about the same time, I hooked up with a speed freak nurse. You know, and through a series of events, I got introduced to this lady. This is another one of those stories. This is the night before Thanksgiving, right? A friend of mine invites this lady over the house, and she's dressed up in her nurse outfit, you know, all white, dressed up in white, you know, Florence Nightingale. And she shows up with a bunch of crank and turns everybody in the house on to all this speed. Then the next morning, we have to go to my mother's for Thanksgiving dinner, right? And we're just fried, and we're sitting there, we're really not hungry, Mom, me and my brother. She said, I fixed all this food, we've got 20 relatives here, and you don't want to eat? And anyway, what happened was, I hooked up with this nurse. She started out as my connection, and she turned me on to drugs, and I turned her on to drinking. And between the two of us, we spent 2.5 years torturing each other. And I've got a whole lot of stories behind that one. Her brother was a biker, and he had a repair shop in Santa Cruz, and so he had all the connections. And so I got to meet all the crazies over on the coast and hang out with them. And you know, I would head for Santa Cruz on Friday nights and come home on Sunday nights to the valley. And I drove many, many Sunday nights blind. And I wouldn't drive 17. I would drive the old road out of SoCal. And, you know, after doing everything under the sun for 2 days, I would, you know, risk my life on Sunday nights to get back to the valley so I could try to make work on Mondays. And I can remember we were living in a little apartment off of Bird Avenue, and my neighbor upstairs was a graduate alcoholic, I guess you might say. He was a man in his 50s who was out of it day in and day out. He was a 24-hour-a-day drinker. And he came down one night to our apartment after we'd been drinking most of the evening, and I had the music on full blast at 2:30, and this guy comes banging on the screen door, and he's yelling, "Turn that damn music down!" So my girlfriend came to the door and said, "What?" And he said, "Send that bearded son of a bitch out here." And so I come flying out that screen door, and I was trying to kill the guy because he told me to turn my music down, right? And I caught him halfway up the stairs, and we were wrestling around. I kicked him in the head with a pair of cowboy boots on. So they arrested me for felony assault with a deadly weapon. So I did. I got sentenced to 3 months for that one, and I remember I got out of Elmwood early. So the first thing I did when I got out of Elmwood was I drove into Milpitas, and I decided to treat myself right. We have to celebrate getting released from jail. So I went to the first liquor store I found after I got out of the parking lot at Elmwood, and I bought 3 six-packs of imported beer. You know, gotta treat yourself right, man. It's party time. So what do I? I got San Miguel and Vex and Heineken, and then I jumped on the freeway and went over to Santa Cruz to see my girlfriend and my buddies over there. Well, I pull up in Santa Cruz, and you know, they're all snorting crank and crazy as hell, and I come walking up, and my girlfriend looks at me and she's like, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I'm all, "Well, that's a fine greeting. And, you know, I've been in jail for 2.5 months." And she's all, "Well, we were going to have a party for you, but you're not supposed to get out till next week." And, you know, I can still remember, they just finished doing a bunch of lines, and she's got a Budweiser, and she sticks her finger in the Budweiser and sticks it up her nose to cool off the crank, right? A lot of class. And what happened was we eventually pulled all kinds of strange numbers on each other, and I ended up living in the De Anza Hotel in downtown San Jose. The De Anza Hotel in 79 was a flea bag. You know, old folks, winos, and street people. And my family didn't want to have anything to do with me. You know, periodically they'd let me back in. You know, I'd bounce off the walls someplace else for a few months until things cooled off, and then I could go hit my relatives up again and they'd tolerate me. Well, this was another one of those periods when, you know, the family didn't want to have anything to do with me because I was nuts. So I rented a room at the De Anza for... what was it? I paid $217 a month and got a deluxe room. Mine had a shower and they changed the sheets once a week, you know? And I remember at the time I was trying to be a full-blown alcoholic and hold down a job as a design draftsman and work back and forth between those two worlds, where I'd show up at a professional electronics plant in the daytime and at night I was living in a flea bag and hanging out in the bar there. And I managed to do that for about 6 months. And I can remember one night I stumbled out of the hotel about 9 o'clock at night, drunk as hell, and I went to get in my old pickup truck. And this van was stopped at the stoplight, and it was a lady that I worked with at the electronics company. You know, and she leaned out the window, and she's like, "You live here, Sam?" You know, she couldn't believe that that was my lifestyle when I wasn't there. I can remember I lived on the 6th floor of the De Anza, and this nurse girlfriend of mine, she came in manic, you know, suicidal one day. You know, she was ready to kill herself, this and that. And so I took her up to my room, and I was trying to talk to her, and so I had to use the bathroom, and I left the room, and I said, "Sit right on this bed, and I'll be right back." And I come back in the room, and the window is wide open, and the wind's blowing the curtains. And she's gone, and I'm all, "Jesus, she jumped out the window, and they're going to think I did it." And what happened was, I walked over to the window expecting to see her splattered on the street, and she jumps up from behind the bed and says, "Thought I jumped, didn't you, you son of a bitch?" Then I wanted to throw her out the window. Right about this time, I had an old beat up Chevy pickup, a 54 Chevy pickup, you know, primer spots all over it, all scratched up, and I decided one night about 1:30 that I was going to go visit this lady friend at the trailer park where my mom lived in Alvisa, you know. So blind drunk, I get in this truck, can't even walk, and I'm in this truck, and the thing was, this thing had lousy door latches, right? All you had to do was lean on the door and it'd just fly right open. Both of them. So, used to be on North First Street. It was all farmer's fields. And it was real dark once you got out there. No streetlights or nothing. And so I'm hanging on the steering wheel, you know, leaning on the door, hanging on the steering wheel. And the truck's driving itself, essentially. Somebody stopped in the middle of First Street there. They just built the first electronics company out there. And this guy's got his van stopped right in the middle of First Street. And I saw it right at the last minute. And I hit the brakes and I hit the door to brace myself. The door flew open and I flew out. My truck drove away by itself. And my first thought was, hey, wait for me. And, you know, there was nobody in the truck. So You know, I did zigzag and went through a barbed wire fence and drove across a farmer's field and it stopped against the fence about a half a block away. You know, and then this guy that's standing there talking to these people, he says, "Hey, buddy, are you okay?" And I look at him and look at my truck and I say, "You son of a..." You know, I start to stand up and walk at him. And boy, he was in his van and down the road, and I'm standing in the middle of a dark country road with the crickets chirping, looking around, going, "What do I do now?" And I said, "Well, geez, I better go turn my headlights off. They're going to see my truck." So, anyway, you know, fall out of your truck and you're sliding down the street doing 20 miles an hour on your belt. You know, that's some of the freaky little things that happen. There were a lot of things that were a lot more violent and a lot more crazy and a lot more sad than that. Alcohol took me a lot of places. You know, I did a lot of things I didn't want to do. I ended up with a lot of people I didn't want to be with. And it was a direct result of my putting alcohol into my body. I remember the last time I was in jail was in 81. And I was unemployed and I was living at my mom's, and to pass the time I was painting pictures. You know, and so I just finished painting a picture and I thought I'd reward myself for creating this beautiful watercolor, right? So I checked my wallet and I had enough to go down and get a half pint of Royal Gate and a little bottle of orange juice, so that's what I did. And then we went back and we got the Royal Gate without the orange juice. And then we were out of money and went down the street and drank somebody else's vodka. And then, before you know it, it's 10 o'clock at night, and I haven't had anything to eat all day, and I'm blind drunk. And my brother comes walking in and mentions something about the neighbor across the street. Well, I didn't like this guy anyway, so that's all it took, just to bring up his name. Well, I'm going to go kick that SOB's ass. So I'm going for the sliding glass door to across the street, and my brother jumps in front of me. "No, no, you don't want to do that." And he's like, "Get out of my way." And he's like, "Whatever." Went across the street, banging on this guy's door. "Come out here, Neil, I'm going to kick your ass." And he wouldn't answer his door, so I started kicking the screen, kicked a big hole in the screen, and I started kicking the door, kicked a big hole in the door. And I look over, and there's the SJPD sitting in the car watching me. So I went over and, you know, I got a t-shirt on, a pair of pants, and I'm barefoot. No money, no wallet. Drunker in hell. I stick my hands out and say, "Well, put the cuffs on me. I guess you got me." So they took me downtown, and they booked me for malicious mischief, drunk in public. And next day I appeared in court, and I said, "Well, what the hell? I'll just plead guilty." So the judge says, 30 days. And so I said, you know, I'm down in those cement tunnels underneath the court after I get sentenced, right? And I'd run into an old friend of mine, you know, one of my buddies. And I'm sitting there crying on his shoulder. "They just gave me 30 days, and all I did was kick his front door." And this other guy is listening to us, and he looks at me, and he's like, "What the hell are you sniveling about? I'm going back to the joint for 5 years tomorrow." So I figured, you know, I just better not be crying about my problems. What happened was they sent me out to Elmwood. I did 30 days in the Wino Barracks, Barracks 10. My job out there was to mop the floor every morning, and they'd give me a bag of Bugler tobacco. And at the time, I was grateful to get that. My buddy Steve over here, I hadn't seen him in a long time. We're partners from 20 years ago. We went through a lot of things together. We know a lot about each other. I go out to Elmwood and I see this guy all dressed in the white uniform for the cafeteria. And there's old Steve. He's shooting the angles out there. "Hey man, I got it down here. I got the best food. And I got connections out here." He's like, "What do you need, bro?" What happened was Steve gave me a pack of generic filter cigarettes, a used coffee cup, a sawed-off toothbrush, and half a tube of toothpaste. And I was grateful. At that time, this is 81. This is 1981. And Steve said, "Hey, I'm going to one of these AA meetings they have out here. You wanna go with me?" And I said, "Sure, you know, I'll check it out." So Steve was busy telling me, "Hey, I'm beat, man. I'm tired. I'm tired of doing what I'm doing and getting what I'm getting." And We went to a couple of AA meetings out there, and he got some of the literature and gave it to me. And he's all, "Hey, why don't you read this, man?" He's all, I'm tired. I'm ready to give it up." And I said, "Yeah, right." And he sobered up, and I kept on going. You know, this is 81, and I kept doing it from then until 84. And I sobered up in January of 84 after drinking and using for about 15 years. And what happened for me to sober up is a lot of stuff happened to me, but there's a lot of stuff that didn't happen that would have, I'm sure. You know, if I hadn't discovered Alcoholics Anonymous and things changed for me, I have no doubt in my mind that I'd be in a jail or a loony bin or dead right now. Because during the 70s, I ended up in two different recovery houses, and that didn't change anything for me, and I didn't hear anything, because at the time, all I was doing was trying to shoot some angles. I didn't have any place to go, so I checked out these recovery houses, three hots and a cot. You know, you got a roof over your head, and they feed you, and all you got to do is play this game like you want to get sober. I did that twice in 75. I spent about half of the year in 1975 in those recovery houses. I ended up in a psychiatric ward at San Jose Hospital. I was at the psych ward at Valley Medical. I was in the emergency rooms getting stitched up for various things at various times. You know, the list goes on and on and on. You know, people trying to murder you, you trying to murder people, wrecking cars, you know, sick relationships, dozens of jobs, on and on and on. You know, there's one story I like to tell. During the 70s, I can't even tell you what year it was, but in the 70s, one time I went out and got loaded for a couple of days, and I was, you know, I was putting anything in me that would get me high, you know, smoke it, eat it, drink it. And what happened was that at the end of the second day, I ended up over somebody's house by San Jose State through this lady I was with, and they were smoking a joint, so come around to me, and I took a couple of big old hits off this joint, and then I come to find out I'm smoking PCP. You know, so what happened was a few minutes later, I was moonwalking, and these people are telling this lady, "Get him the hell out of here. He's going to get us arrested." So they took me over to my mom's house one more time, and they dumped me off. And in my mind, I was thinking Satan was after my soul, you know. Devil's trying to get me, and I got to get away from this. And I tore all my clothes off, and I flipped over all the furniture, and I kicked out all the windows. And then I looked around at what I had done, and I said, something told me in my mind, you need help. I think you got to go to the psych ward. Yeah, something in my mind said, you got to go check into the psych ward. So instead of walking through the door, I climbed through the broken window, right? For whatever reason, naked. I didn't have a stitch of clothes on. I was naked. And I walked up to Bascom Avenue and proceeded to walk to Valley Medical nude. And I think the reason I made it there was because it was late at night. It was like 2:30 in the morning, and there was hardly anybody out on the street. And to tell you how sick I was, I got to Stevens Creek and Bascom, and I pushed the button and waited till it said walk. You know, it's kind of foggy outside, you know, and the sheriff is bored, and he's standing on the front lawn watching the hospital. And I walk up behind him and tap him on the shoulder. So he turned around and took one look at me and jumped back a couple of paces and didn't know what the hell to do with me. You know? What I like to tell people is obviously I didn't have any concealed weapons. And what he did was he spun me around and put me in handcuffs naked. And I had all these little cuts and scrapes all over me from flipping out. He took me in the emergency room, and they stitched me up, and then they checked me into the psych unit. Well, by the next morning, I'm coming down, and I'm just hungover and ashamed and embarrassed and confused, and my head's about this big, and it's like, what the hell do I do now? So I had to call my mother to bring me some clothing so I could get out of the place. And They took me in front of the board, and they realized right away that I wasn't a psychiatric case. I was an alcoholic, you know, and that was their finding on me. This guy's an alcoholic, and we can't help you. So they cut me loose to my mom, and as I was walking out of the place, you know, with my head down, following my mom, the sergeant, all these cops, looks at me and he says, "Hey, Sam, good to see you again. Don't forget your uniform next time." And that's a story that always stands out for me of how insane things were, that a few days or a week would go by and it was back to business as usual. You know, it won't happen again. You know, I'll get things under control. That last time I was in jail, I stayed sober on self-will for 4 months after I got out in 81. I got this thing going where I did 30 days, so I didn't take nothing when I was in there. And then when I got out, something was telling me, hey, this stuff does not happen when you don't drink. You know, when you're not taking stuff, all this weird shit does not happen to you. So I remember getting out, and of course nobody was there to meet me. And my mom lived in Alviso, so I could walk from Elmwood to her house. And I stopped at a phone booth trying to get a hold of her to come and pick me up, and somebody had left a half-filled Budweiser sitting on this payphone, you know, and I'm dialing my mom, looking at this half-filled Budweiser on the payphone, going, Jesus, that's my problem right there, sitting on this payphone. And what happened is I white-knuckled it. I wheezled my way back into mom's house one more time, and I decided I was just not going to drink. So to not drink, I got myself another job, and I would go to work, and I would come home from work, I would turn on the TV set, and I would build model airplanes. And it was like I hated myself, I hated the world, I hated my job, I had no friends, I was pissed off. But I knew I couldn't drink because I was always flying off and all this weird stuff had happened to me. So I got into these balsa and paper airplanes. You know, you put a little power motor on, they're free flight. But the deal is, these things take like 40 hours to build. And I'd pin them down and glue them together, and I'd put the paper on there and spray it, and it'd get taut, and I'd put the decals, and I'd do everything. You know how it is, perfectionism, you know, trying to do everything just so, and it's got to be just right. And that's another symptom of my problem, is that I'm always seeking perfection, not progress. You know, and inside my life was a shambles, so outside I was trying to put things in order. And what happened was I'd spend 40 hours on these little planes, and I'd put a motor on them, fire them up, throw them, they'd go in a circle, crash into the ground, and I'd get another kit and start over again. I built six of these things, man, at 40 hours apiece, because that's how I was occupying myself so I didn't climb the walls and completely lose it. What happened was after about 3 months of this kind of behavior, you know, hiding from myself and the world, a friend of my brother's come by one night and he had a six-pack of Erlanger beer. Never heard of it before or since. And he starts passing out beers and he gets to me and he holds the beer out to me. He's like, "Oh, that's right, you're on the wagon, huh, Sam?" And I said, "Give me that beer." And after 4 months without a drink, by the end of that night, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels and a half case of beer by my side, and I was drunk as a lord at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was trying to convince my brother to stay awake and party with me, and he's looking at me saying, "I don't know what you're doing, but I got to go to work in the morning." When I finally sobered up, I was living in a little studio apartment about a block and a half from the rescue mission, overlooking Tico's Tacos. That was a pretty squirrely neighborhood. I used to hear all of these backfires outside, and you could never decide whether it was a gun or a backfire. And you'd hear, you know, people beating each other up and glass breaking and all kinds of strange things all hours of the night. And what happened was, here's one for you. The very last job I got before I sobered up, I applied for a job in a three-piece pinstripe suit with a black eye. What happened was I had gone to one of these thrift stores and they had this really cool polyester bell-bottom suit from the 70s. And I thought that would look really good for interviews. And So I put on this suit. Well, leading up to it, I got drunk at a friend's house, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I picked a fight with this 16-year-old kid, thinking I was, Mr. Badass, and this kid just fired on me like that. I mean, you know, my reflexes were not at home. And this kid gave me a big black eye, and then, of course, I'm trying to blow it off. Hey, man, I'm sorry. I was in the cube, and hey, cool down. And what happened was that at the end of that night, I was trying to beg a beer off the guy that had just given me a black eye. And he just looked at me disgusted and gave me a beer. And so what happened was I applied for a job wearing dark glasses and this polyester suit. Then I figured it wasn't cool and that maybe I'd risk it and take off the glasses and he wouldn't say anything about my black eye, right? He didn't. You know, he didn't even ask about it. And he hired me. And that job lasted all of 3 weeks. You know, it had lots of promise and lots of potential, but I was an alcoholic. My alcoholism came first above everything. What happened was 3 weeks into the job, I went over to my mom's, it was Mother's Day, I think. No, it was her birthday, that was it. It was her birthday. And we went to get her some flowers, my brother and I, and he had a bottle of vodka, and he's like, hey, come on, have a couple of drinks with me, Sam. And I said, Tommy, I can't drink that. You know, I don't know what's going to happen if I have a couple of drinks with you. And he's like, hey, man, it's only a pint. Come on, just have a couple snorts. Well, took a couple drinks of that vodka, and I was off and running. I was off to the races for 2 or 3 days. Didn't go into work, didn't call in. And I woke up on a Thursday morning after drinking everything in sight for a couple of days, and I was so manic, you know. My head felt like somebody put an axe in the back of it, you know, and I had that oily sweat that smells like alcohol and poison, and I was pacing back and forth in my apartment, and I was right in the middle of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I was at the end of my rope, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. Well, through a series of events, I decided to look in the Yellow Pages, and I called all these places under alcoholism in the Yellow Pages. And everybody asked, do you have any insurance? If you don't have any insurance, we don't know what to tell you, da-da-da-da-da. Well, what happened was a couple days went by, and I decided that maybe I'm being a little hasty, and my life's not as out of control as I think it is. And I started to back down from the idea of looking up alcoholism services or AA or anything like that. And, you know, through a series of events, you know, God always shows up at the right moment. I know that today. A friend of my brother's had a drunk driving. And he said, hey, man, you've been talking about going to this AA. I've got this piece of paper I got to get signed. Let's go find an AA meeting. And I said, well, all right. So what happened was on a Sunday afternoon, I ended up in an AA meeting in Dollars Park in Santa Clara. And I was still feeling physically bad, and I was just really depressed, you know. I was bewildered. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I was sitting in the back of the room with my baseball cap pulled down, trying to be truly anonymous and not be noticed. And the guy chairing the meeting pointed right to me. And he's like, you, what about you? What are you doing here? You know, I looked around and I said, me? What am I doing here? And he said, yeah, what are you doing here? And I was at the end of my rope. I stood up and I said, I don't want to end up in the emergency room anymore. I don't want to end up in the psych ward anymore. I don't want to end up in the county jail anymore. And I don't want to die. That's why I'm here. And all these people started smiling and laughing and cheering and clapping. And, you know, I looked around the room and I said, what the hell is wrong with these people? I'm dying inside, and they're happy about it. But, you know, the point was is that was the end of my old life. And these people had some kind of idea what was going on, and I didn't have a clue. Through a series of events, I got steered around to Saturday Night Live within a week and a half of that meeting. You know, by the grace of God, I didn't have a drink for, a week, week and a half after that meeting. And I ended up at Saturday Night Live with a cup of coffee in my hand. And I didn't know anybody, and I was really feeling uptight, and I didn't know how to introduce myself. And I was looking at the floor, walking down the middle aisle, and I hear this voice say, hey, Sam, what are you doing? And I look up, and it's old Steve. And come to find out that he'd been sober since I'd seen him in jail a couple years earlier. And that his life was working. And that was the first example for me. He had a wife and a young baby, and he had this really sharp-looking van, custom van, and he was making a ton of money working overtime, and he was wearing a nice leather jacket, and he had what I wanted. And what happened was, my first 6 months of sobriety, I was still living in that little apartment downtown by the rescue mission, and Steve used to come by on Saturdays. And he'd take me down to the House of Pancakes and try to make simple conversation, which is something that at the time that I wasn't even capable of. And we'd go down there, and he'd be trying to joke around with me, and, "Hi, how you doing, and what's been going on with you this week?" And it was like, I was like a clam. It was hard to pry a few sentences out of me. And that was a beginning for me. I can remember sitting in the back of the room 6 months sober. And I had tunnel vision, you know. I saw the smoky room and all of these people in front of me and somebody in the front of the room talking, and something in my brain said, "You know what? It's been 6 months and you haven't had a drink. You've been sober for 6 months and you've been showing up at this room on a regular basis." You know, it was like a revelation, you know. At the time it was a revelation to me that I realized that something was working for me. I can remember one morning when I was still living in that a place downtown. I was feeling pretty cheerful. I got up early in the morning and took my shower and put on my nice jacket, and I went down to get in my car and go to work, and I'm unlocking the door and I see these two guys stumbling up the street. And I said, "Jesus, look at those guys." And they had leaves in their hair, and they're both carrying trash bags with their earthly belongings in them. They got a little closer and I recognized one of them. And it was a guy I went to high school with who was my nephew's godfather. And he'd been this this hip young kid, this sharp dresser, this cool guy when we were younger. And he was a street bum, you know, who slept in the bushes or wherever. And I said, "Hey, Jimmy." And this guy looked at me and it didn't quite register. And then he recognized me. He's like, "Hey, Sam, what are you doing?" He came walking up to me, you know, and I'm trying to be friendly. I reached out to shake his hand, and then I noticed that he'd either been stomped or burned or something, and his hand was all swollen up and scabbed over. And I, Jesus, I don't want to shake his hand. But, I forced myself to shake his hand, and I said, "Well, what's going on?" And he said, "Oh, nothing much, man. You got a cigarette?" You know, and I looked at Jimmy, and I saw where I could be, you know. At the end of my drinking, my main drinking partner was one of my younger brothers, Tommy. And when I sobered up, I went one way, and Tommy continued on with what we'd been doing. And in 1988, my brother was hanged from a telephone cord in the county jail. And that's another signpost for me. Could have been me in his place. You know, I was no different than he was. I have an older sister who died of cirrhosis of the liver. I've got a sister who drinks half gallons of hard liquor and talks to people who aren't there. I've got a little brother who moved to Colorado because a geographic to leave the state is the solution to his problems today. I don't have to look any further than my immediate family to see alcoholism and what it does to people and what it does to families. I've been sober since January of 84. You know, and I just celebrated 8 years in January. I sobered up on Friday the 13th, 1984. And since that time, the number 13 has been my lucky number. A lot of things have happened over the space of the last 8 years. I just recently got a new sponsor, and he's a good man. He calls me on my bullshit. You know, what happens is I don't need people who are going to pat me on the back and tell me everything's okay and it's going to be okay. You know, I've got to have somebody rattle my cage and tell me when things aren't right. One of the things that my new sponsor does with me is he essentially tells me who I am is not who I was. Because I keep using the past as a reference point for who I am and what I am today, and that's not the truth. The truth is, a lot has transpired in my life since I quit drinking. And a lot of useful information and a lot of good people have come into my life. And if I choose to use it, then miraculous things can happen for me and others. But I have a way of falling back into that pattern where it was always that way, it's always going to be that way, and it's never going to change. You know, when I get into that self-pity scene, and my life doesn't seem to be going my way, and it doesn't seem to be working, then I fall back into that old mode of thinking and acting, and mostly reacting to life. You know, what happens in these rooms is people tell me it's all about action, Sam. You know, and when I'm not into action, then I'm pointing the finger, or I'm blaming myself for what's not happening for me. And that's been the story of my life, actually. I grew up a self-centered, spoiled child, and I never grew out of that. You know, I don't think I progressed emotionally anywhere past the age of 13, and I stayed that way until I was in my 30s. It's like, what can you do for me? You know? If it's not doing something for somebody else without expecting anything in return, that wasn't in my modus operandi. You know, I'll say things to my sponsor like, trying to come up with an example. It's like I was saying earlier, where I'll be using my past as a reference point, and I'll say, no, that's not who you are, that's who you were. You know, and he calls me on it right away. You know, he won't let me get a sentence out, and he calls me on it, and I like that. At first I'm pissed. You know, I'm pissed. Don't talk to me like that. Don't cut me off in mid-sentence. Don't tell me I'm wrong. You know, that's been part of my problem all my life. You know, I'm either entirely right or I'm entirely wrong. People talk about it all the time around here. You know, being centered, finding the middle of the road. And that's a hard thing for me still today. You know, to tell all of you the truth, before I got this sponsor I have now, I was bouncing off the walls for about 3 years. You know, besides coming to AA meetings, hanging out with a group of friends and associates and talking a lot of BS, I wasn't doing a whole hell of a lot. And it gets painful. You know, in my life, fear turns into anger, anger turns into rage, and then I alienate myself and everybody around me. And I can tell a little story behind that. Just we'll talk about what's been going on recently to wrap this up. What happened is about 3 months ago, I blew a job off. See, I've been a job shopper for probably 12 or 13 out of the last 15 years because it was always convenient for me to blow them off, see? If I'm not permanent, if I don't have any roots, then you can't tell me what to do. And I get the impression that I can call the shots, right? Well, through this agency I've been working with for about 4 years, I got a temporary position of 4 to 6 weeks as a drafter, right? Well, as soon as I walk in the place, I don't like the way they're treating me. I walk in and the guy's got a folding table in a busy corridor. And that's where I'm going to sit. And I look at that table and I say, here we go. I'm not happy. So for 3 months, this guy keeps me on this folding table in a corridor with a junk computer. And I finally get a cubicle, you know, 3 months into this job. So for another 2.5, I'm still pissed off, still hanging on to what happened in the beginning and saving things as I go on. I'm pissed. I'm really pissed. You people are not treating me right. You're showing me no respect. Don't you know who I am? Well, 5.5 months into the job, I'm trying to manipulate getting out on unemployment. You know, I'm telling my immediate supervisor, hey, you know what? I don't want to come back after the holidays, but I don't want it to be a quit. I want it to be a layoff. And he says, oh, no problem. I'll go talk to the boss. Talks to the boss, comes back and says, hey, everything's cool. You can do that. I say, all right. So, 24th of December, I call the boss over to sign my time card. And I said, well, you know, there's only that one problem. We want to call it a layoff. We don't want it to be a quit. And he looks at me and says, oh, I can't do that. That would be a lie. You know, I went through the roof. You know, my face starts turning red and I start shaking. And I'm like, Jesus, this guy's he's ruining the best plans of mice and men here. And what happened was, I said, look, I've worked my ass off for this company for 5.5 months. And he looks at me and says, and we paid you for it, didn't we? And I said, you know what, Mike, fuck you. You know, and the way I said it was enraged with my eyes about this big, and he's all, what's wrong with this guy? He's a lunatic. And he didn't want to have no piece of that. So he looked at me for a minute, and he's all, well, you have a nice holiday, Sal. And that just made me angrier, and I said, fuck you! And so I stomped out of the place, self-righteous anger. They're not treating me right. Look at what they just did. They screwed me over and they ruined my plans. Well, what happened was, through a series of events that I started, nobody did it to me. I go back to the job shop and try to justify myself. And I'm trying to talk around the issue of what I said to them and what really transpired. And she says, well, what happened? What did you say to him? So I had to cop to it, and then I'm trying to justify why I did that. Well, they didn't treat me right and this and that and this and that. Well, what happened is this job shop, who I made over $100,000 working for, the last time I talked to him on the phone, she said, can I get back to you? Click. And that's how they dealt with me, because it wasn't the first time I'd used anger to manipulate and justify my own actions. And then I went to the unemployment people, and they said, no unemployment for you, bud. You quit. You know, and we understand that you were swearing at this guy and everything else. So, you know, all the information went on down the line, and all these bridges started getting burned for me. So I was frantic, you know, and I was off work for 2 months, and I had no visible means of support, and I was trying to make things happen. You know, I'm at unemployment, and I went down to the general assistance office, and I'm signing up for food stamps and welfare, and I'm trying to make something happen. I've got to get my life together here. Well, nothing was working for me, you know, and 2 months down the road, a relative loaned me some money to pay my rent, and then all of a sudden, this job drops out of the sky, sort of, you know. God taking care of me when I finally gave up, when I finally let go, when I said, I don't know what to do now. What's going to happen? I don't know what to do. You know, it's in your hands, Father. I get a call from the shop, and they say, well, we've got this job at a company that designs and builds video games. You know, fun stuff. I'm a draftsman, and I've been drawing straight lines for government projects for most of my career. And here this job falls out of the sky where they want me to do fun stuff and play with video games. I go to this place. They've got six video games in the cafeteria for the employees to play. You know, as soon as I got in the place, the guy sits me down and says, you got to understand, what we do here is not fucking rocket science. You know, everything's cool. You know, maintain. We don't do things perfect here. And what it was a difference between night and day, and I didn't have anything to do with it, you know. 2 months earlier, I was raging. I was a raving lunatic bouncing off the walls. And when I gave up, and I just did a few simple things and did the footwork, it fell into place for me. And I wasn't manipulating, and I didn't have anything to do with the outcome. See, I believe that God has only my best interest in mind, but I have to let go first. You know, I'm one of those guys, I either want to control everything or I don't give a shit. And the thing that I'm learning, you know, it's progress, not perfection here. And the thing that I'm learning that I keep forgetting, you know, I keep forgetting basic principles around here, and it's like, you know, I got to be smacked in the side of the head. Hey, Sam, don't you remember? We went through this one before. And it seems like everything is a repetitious lesson for me. You know, I'm one of those hard heads. I don't get it the first time. But what I know is by showing up here on a regular basis over a period of 8 years, my life has changed. A lot of opportunities have been dropped right into my lap. There are a lot of people who've tried to be my friend. My girlfriend points out to me all the time, when I get in those manic states where nobody loves me, I don't have any friends, everything's too weird. And then she says, well, wait a minute. Didn't so-and-so call you last week? Didn't you just run into so-and-so and he was talking to you the other day? The thing is, it's not other people. It's not outside influence. It's me. I have to change me. I have to change my actions. And I have to open up to other people. Because what you get is what you put out there. You know, and I used to think, before I got to AA, I used to think, they're doing it to me again. Why are they always doing it to me? And nobody was doing anything to me. I was doing it to myself. But I was so blind, I was so lost that I couldn't see it. In closing, I'd just like to say that I'm grateful that I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and my life has changed as a direct result of the program of AA, and that I'm not perfect, I've never been perfect, and I never will be perfect, but things have changed and improved in innumerable ways. over a period of time. You know, it's a slow trudge. And I know for myself that I've got to stay in contact with this program on a daily basis for the rest of my life, one day at a time. Because left to my own devices, I would be where my friends and my relatives are today. Thanks a lot.